This is Giving the Game Away with Cam Scott and Joel Barber, and our series of podcasts features interviews with a range of elite athletes, including Olympic gold medalists, international footballers, and BBC Sports Personality of the Year winners.
This is a podcast that aims to explore the areas of an athlete's life that aren't often talked about, such as dealing with rejection, recovering from injuries, and handling the media. We also think there are so many lessons to learn from top-level sport, and by exploring the journeys of these athletes, we are hoping to show how those learnings can be applied to our own journeys, whether in sport or in our day-to-day lives.
And coming up on today's episode.
But just remember, when you stand on that tee, and you stand behind the ball, you look down the fairway, and it's 10 deep the whole way down around the green, and the place goes quiet. Just remember the noise that's going to raise if you smash this down the middle of the fairway. So rather than thinking, I hope I make contact, I hope I don't duff it, I hope I don't squirt it out right or whatever, just think, I've got the power of 25,000 people in the palm of my hands here. I'm a great believer in sounding boards. Alex Ferguson came to mind. He just retired from Man United. So anyway, long story short, I got in touch with him, and it wasn't just going in, okay, Alex, tell me how to captain the Raddick Cup team. You know, but there were specific areas that I needed a little bit of insight. And that was one of them, managing the top players and superstars was one of them. You know, he managed, obviously, Ronaldo and Beckham and Giggs and all of those guys, keen in their day. So that's the kind of way that I used them. Every 2 years, you get the Raddick Cup comes together, and all of a sudden, these guys who were trained to be individuals are thrown into this environment, this washing machine atmosphere of being a team, and it's out of their environment, it's out of their natural habitat. So what I tried to do was make that habitat as normal as it would be on a week-to-week basis, because that's what they're used to, that's what they thrive under, and that's, you know, so if they wanted to come in and mold with each other, let them do under their terms, not being forced on by the team. So that's why I took away a lot of the structure as much as I could.
So after a little bit of a break, we're back with some more episodes of the podcast, and we're really excited to bring you conversations with some of the most interesting minds in sport. Starting with today's episode with one of the most recognisable faces from the world of golf, Paul McGinley. Paul was a top 20 in the world ranked golfer, but is actually perhaps best known for his integral involvement in two of Europe's finest moments in Ryder Cup history. Firstly, he sunk the winning putt to secure the 2002 Ryder Cup, and then he went on to captain his continent to victory in the 2014 competition. He has so many learnings from both of those experiences about leadership and captaincy, and he delves into all of those with us today.
An incredible experience chatting to Paul. He was obviously an amazing golfer, but he's also so well known for his ability to lead teams and to unite groups of people all with different motivations, backgrounds and personalities into the achievement of one goal together. In our chat, he talks about the learnings he took from working alongside Sir Alex Ferguson, as well as some of the leadership skills and tactics that he's used to allow players like Rory McIlroy to relax and execute when the pressure is at its highest. So without further ado, here is our conversation with Paul McGinley. Paul, thanks very much for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time to speak to us. I know it's very early where you are. If we start with your childhood and how you got into golf, essentially, I know that with golf, very often it's the case that people are playing sort of from 4 or 5 years old and they're noted as stars from a very young age. But with you, it was actually, you were kind of into Gaelic football and then an injury turned things a little bit. And from there, you kind of took off in golf. So would you mind just giving us a little overview of your career and how you actually got into golf, really?
Yeah, and you know, in some ways, my story is a bit of an inspirational story. I tell a lot of kids when I'm doing clinics for kids that, you know, you don't have to be this boy wonder, Rory McIlroy style, you know, in your, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13 years of age, in order to be a professional golfer. There's some people develop later than others. And certainly my background was one of, you know, very normal background in Dublin back in the 80s, growing up playing Gaelic football, playing hurling, playing soccer, playing a bit of golf during the summer. My dad was a very good player and he was a scratch one handicapper. And I used to caddy for him and he used to play the big amateur events in Ireland. And then when September came back, went down to football booths and training and playing for the school, playing for the club, escalating through under 12s all the way up to playing senior level at that level. And then at the age of 19, Whereas there were probably about 4 or 5 handicap at that stage. You know, golf, certainly professional golf, was miles away from what I thought my life was going to revolve around. And at age of 19, I broke my kneecap playing football. I was very good at it, I say so myself. You know, I was certainly planning on playing at the very, very top level in that, and I wasn't far off it at that time. But I broke my kneecap, I was on crutches for 6 months. I was at college at the time in Dublin. And when I came off the crutches, I couldn't play football again or hurling or anything like that in those contact sports. So my last 2 years of college in Dublin, I started to play golf 12 months of the year during the winter as well. You know, my handicap came down to about 1. And then I did what's called a stagiaire, which is a post-grad work experience job over in EC in Brussels for 6 months. It was the first time I'd left Ireland. And went over there and I worked there for 6 months, worked for an investment company in Dublin for 6 months, you know, earning a bit of an income. And all the time I was playing away at my golf, and my golf got down to be pretty good. And then I got to a stage to think, okay, I'm 21 years of age. I thought I want to work in an office the rest of my life. I'm getting kind of good at this golf. I know I'm 21 though. And see if I get a scholarship to go to America and kill 2 birds at 1 stone, burden my education, and play a bit of golf. One thing led to another. That's where I ended up. And, you know, 3 years later, I was at the tour school and came second and got onto tour.
Awesome. And yeah, I mean, you by your own admission, yeah, you weren't a boy wonder like Rory McIlroy, but you were a late bloomer. But by all means, you ended up having a very successful career in golf. You were a top 20 ranked player. What do you think allowed you to develop into such a good player then in such a short space of time? Was it your work ethic? Was it because you had the right mindset and you were very psychologically resilient? What was it that you think made you so good?
Well, I think it was a combination of all of those things, to be honest. I mean, even, you know, I never was the most natural player, even on tour. The game never came easy to me. Other things in my life have come a lot easier to me, like the leadership talks that I'm doing now, the captaincy in the Ryder Cup, even playing in the Ryder Cup as part of the team. They were all a lot easier, came easier to me than being the individual out there for 25 weeks a year, traveling the world and trying to compete against these players who were so much more talented than me. But what I had was, I think, ambition more than anything else. You know, my ambition was revolving around Gaelic football at a younger age. And when that was taken away from me, I channeled all of that into my golf. And also I collided with a number of really beneficial things that happened. Good breaks. We all need good breaks in life. But when I went to college in America, I'd never been there before. I didn't know where I was going. I ended up in San Diego. I ended up with the most amazing coach over there. And he took me from a very raw, guy straight out of the green fields of Ireland and cultured me and made me into somewhat of a good player and a competitor. And, you know, culminating 2 years later, playing World Cup and turning professional. So I was very fortunate because there's hundreds of colleges, as you know, in America. I could have gone anywhere. I didn't know where I was going. It was the only offer I got was to San Diego. But I ended up with a brilliant coach, and it was tough love with him too. You know, it wasn't like arm around his shoulder, you're great, you're going to be this. It was the opposite. It was hard. It was tough love. But, you know, he turned me into a pretty good player. I went to the tour school, to be honest. I didn't know if I was going to come through. You know, guys like Darren Clark, who was on tour, and all of those guys who were playing amateur golf with were miles ahead of me. And Darren had come onto the tour, and he got his card, but it hadn't come easy to him in the first year. And I thought, well, you know, at least I'd have a go with the tour school. I don't know if I'll make it or not. Anyway, I put the blinkers on once round after another. I qualified from stage 1 to stage 2 to stage 3. 6 rounds in the qualifying. And, you know, one thing led to another, and I came second. And there I was on tour before I knew it. I was like, oh my God, what do I do now? And I battled a bit the first year, to be honest. He ended up finishing 97th on the money list. It was a pretty ugly. It wasn't like amazing golf. I didn't hit the ground running. I missed more cuts than I made. But I had a few good weeks here and there. But what I did was get my feet under the table as a professional golfer. I was very well managed by Chubby Chandler. He did a great job with me, ex-player. I took him part of his stable. So he was very good becoming that father figure to me as a professional golfer. Obviously, my dad was there very much in the background too. So I had good people around me. And then I came across Bob Torrence, and Bob Torrence took me from this raw guy just about kept his card and wasn't really going anywhere. And he turned me into a golfer of a pretty good standard, as you say, top 20 in the world I've reached. And that was Bob. You know, Bob gave me the fundamentals to be a ball striker and to, you know, be a good player, become the player that I was.
Do you think you almost had an advantage in a way, because not that you had a plan B, but you had your degree, you'd had sporting experience before in another sport. You obviously had all that work experience. It wasn't like you see with a lot of kids now where, like you said before about boy wonders, like from the age of 10, they have to be a professional golfer and that's just it. Do you think it almost worked to your advantage in that way?
I think it did. I think it did. I certainly took the pressure off me. And that's what I try to say when I do clinics to the young kids, you know, have a plan B. And, you know, so when I went to the tour school, I didn't have the same pressure of the other guys who left school at 15 and 16, but all the races into the one basket of being a professional golfer with no plan B if it didn't work out. I went to the tour school thinking, this is probably not going to work out, but it's okay. I've got a degree in my back pocket. I've got a diploma in marketing in my back pocket of 5 years of education. I've traveled to America. I've got lots of contacts now. I'll probably get a job and I go back to being an amateur again. But it's interesting. It's a very interesting thing because I had this conversation with Tom Lehman, the American golfer, a few years ago, who helps with the recruiting for Minnesota, the University of Minnesota, which is one of the top universities over here. And he says when he's looking for guys, he's looking for guys that don't have a plan B. He wants guys that only have a plan A. So in other words, they're focused, they're committed, and they're going to drive everything into being good golfers. And I had a different view to say, well, actually, my experience was the opposite. And, you know, the fact that I had a plan B took pressure off me and alleviated me and go. So, you know, there's two different ways of looking at it. But it's interesting that he had that perspective.
There was probably the element of it as well where you were playing, obviously you wanted to get better, but you were playing a lot for the fun of it. You had your studies on the side and the enjoyment of the game was the main thing that was carrying through to your practice. And as a result, you did more than that, allowed you to get to the level you are rather than it just being something, right, I have to get better at this. I have to do well, all that pressure.
I think that was part of it. But I think the biggest thing for me was, you know, and this is where I was really blessed. Okay, I might have been blessed with talent and gems in the golf ball that others were, or distance or all those things that are such huge requirements and assets and certainly shortcuts to being successful. But what I was blessed with was this burning ambition inside my belly every single day. I was so determined and I had incredible. I wanted to break free from, you know, this, you know, all due respect, this middle class restricted lifestyle in Ireland growing up. And, you know, we had a wonderful, I had a great childhood and a wonderful family, but I was the eldest of five kids and, you know, there wasn't a lot of money around. And I had this incredible burning ambition for my teenagers to be something, to be successful at something. And I was able, as I say, channel that away from football when I got the bad news that I couldn't play anymore and turn it into golf. So that's what I was blessed with more than anything. And that's a blessing from above that, you know, to wake up every morning fully energized and committed and can't wait to get out practicing, can't get there. And I still have it. I'm very lucky to have that. So it's, you know, I'm here today. It's early in the morning, but I'm looking forward to practicing today. I still want to play, even though 56 now to play a little bit, only play half a dozen events or so a year. But I still love doing the work. I still love doing my gym work. I love doing my stretching. And I particularly love practicing, chipping and putting, figure things out, playing shots, getting shots, playing games, being competitive. So I think that's my, you know, that's what I was blessed with. And anybody who has that has a huge advantage in life, no matter what it can be. It doesn't have to be channeled into being a golfer. You channel it into different ways. But that burning sensation and ambition in your belly every day of energize and energy is hugely, hugely beneficial. In fact, I put that more important than having talent. If you don't have that, no matter how talented you are, it's going to
So yeah, no, that sounds like you've got such an elite mindset, Paul, where you're always looking to better yourself. And as you say, that sometimes that graft is more important than the talent itself. What I'm also interested in is the fact that you were so successful in teams in your playing career. You represented Europe on 14 occasions, winning 13 of those. Why was it that you were so good in teams? I think you've spoken before about how actually you felt less pressure playing in teams. Why do you think that was?
Well, first of all, the reason why the record is so good is because I had great teammates. I mean, as you know, I don't win all the points to win on my own. Although my record was very good, if you put my record around with all of the teams that I played in, it's up near 70%, which is off the scale in team events. Whereas, you know, you take Poulter, he has that in Ryder Cup alone, which makes him an incredible Ryder Cup player that he has been. But all mine, the Seve trophies, the Royal trophies put together was that. So teammates are really important and obviously partners when it comes to foursomes and form ball. But again, it's a contrary view. A lot of professional golfers will say, I hated playing part in teams. I feel so much extra pressure. I don't want to let anybody down. It's so difficult. I'm under more pressure than I am when I'm playing individually. That's the norm that we said earlier, contrary views that Tom Lehman had when it came to recruiting. I think when it comes to playing in teams, you know, there's contrary views as well. And the majority of people would be of that mindset that it's incredibly difficult. You don't want to let anybody down. It's difficult to play with a partner on your shoulder, you know, all of those things. I felt the opposite. And that was my own personal experience to say, you know, I had this view, how crazy it was. And I don't know, but my view was, you know, I can play crap here today. I can lose my game 8-7, but the team can still win. And I'm good with that. And because I had that attitude, because it was almost, I wasn't afraid of losing. I wasn't afraid of letting anybody down. And I had such faith in my teammates that unlocked me and freed me to go ahead and play the freedom that's required to be successful. So I felt that played with more freedom, to answer your question, when I was part of a team. And it was probably because I had this kind of security blanket around me of the quality of the rest of the players.
I guess with professional golf as well, is so much of the time it's about being selfish, and people get to the point they're at by their ego and it being all revolved around them. So some people sometimes struggle when they're then thrown in a team environment. It's no longer just about them. It's about this collective team instead.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I felt. I love, you know, and I think, again, I'm sure a psychologist will be able to look deeper into my childhood. You know, my childhood was not on the practice grounds on my own, isolated for 4 or 5 hours every day. You know, this is kind of upbringing that Nick Faldo talks about, you know, that isolation, being on his own and happy in his own company. That wasn't my background. My background was in a dressing room. My background was singing on the bus on the way back from matches. My background was playing all kinds of sports, part of the team, and getting stuck into the dynamics of being in a team. So, you know, all of that stood me in good stead. When I became a good enough player to make teams, it was an easy fit for me. I fitted right in, and having a guy on my shoulder, you know, sitting in a locker room with a guy as a teammate, you know, that psychologically, that put me at ease as well.
You certainly thrived in those team environments, and perhaps your biggest highlight performing in a team was that 2002 Ryder Cup victory at the Belfry, where you sunk the winning putt on the 18th against Jim Furyk. From what I've heard, when you've talked about that putt before, it seems that actually you didn't have that many nerves, which it seemed crazy to me, such a big moment. Why were you able to be so confident in that moment?
Because I was in the zone. You know, when you're in the zone, there's a freedom. And I was in the zone, and the zone is very much in the present. It's very much about the process. It's very much about, you know, activating what you need to do to hit the shot, play the putt. And you know, I wasn't in that all the time in my career, but luckily at that moment in time, I was very focused, and I didn't know I was going to hold a putt, but I knew I was going to hit a great putt. And that was good enough for me. You know, again, that gave me the freedom to go ahead unrestricted, and I wasn't kind of jamming it in, or I wasn't tight, or I wasn't afraid of missing. You know, I hit it such confidently because, as I say, I wasn't afraid of missing. I saw the button when I saw it. I think, you know, being in the zone, and being in the zone is somewhat unconscious of what you're doing. It's like driving a car down. You know, I say to you this morning, you know, how do you get into work this morning? How did you get, you know, do you remember driving? And you go, well, not really. I've driven so long. I just kind of changed the gears and I turned the wheel and I know where I'm going. And I'm thinking about 4 or 5 other things while I'm driving. And yet you drove probably immaculately getting in here or getting into your office. And that's what it's like playing golf. You're on automatic pilot. And you're not always like that. That's what's called being in the zone, is when you're in an automatic pilot. And, you know, at that moment in time, at birdie 17, the crux and the pressure was kind of going right to here. And that kind of drove me into this focused mindset. And as I say, blessed that's the mind that I was in. And it was one of fearfulness, because there was a lot of wonder moments under pressure where I was fearful and made mistakes under pressure as a consequence. But at that moment in time, certainly in 2002, and indeed most of the teams that I played in, as I say, this alleviation of fear was gone, and I was more freewheeling, and with freedom, that's when you do your best.
Yeah, certainly sounds like you're in a flow state. And yeah, from what we've heard from athletes before, when you're in that flow state is when you perform your best. I think that there'll be amateur golfers listening to this who will have been stood over a putt, whether they're playing for a tenner with their mates, and they'll be stood over the putt thinking in their head, please don't miss this, please don't miss this. So for you to then be over a putt that has so much on the line, were you generally not thinking, oh no, what happens if I miss this? You were actually thinking, this is my opportunity to be a hero and win the Ryder Cup. It was more positive rather than the fear.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I wasn't always like that, but certainly in that instance, I've been, you know, bad under pressure and I've been good under pressure. And you learn from those things. And now as I kind of removed the bits, but I can look back in and see what the mindset was. And yeah, the mindset was absolutely, it was a positive mindset. And, you know, that idea I tried to bring to my captaincy in 2014 and I tried to highlight it into situations. And you know, the mindset I had in 2002 was, of course it came into my head, you know, of course you know, you're not so unconscious that you don't know the consequences of what's going on. Of course I had this talk come into my head fleetingly, you know, don't leave it short, you know, don't leave it a foot short, or, you know, don't stub it, or, you know, don't miss it low. Now, those came in, but they went out because I was so focused into my process of where the line is, what I had to do, where the hole was. And I was in that energy of getting the ball into the hole. And I brought that into 2014. And an example of that, you know, in terms of the meetings that we did, what, you know, try to create that mindset of, just give an example, the first tee. You know, a lot of ex-players in particular will tell you about how nervous you are at the first tee. You stand in the first tee, you got the amphitheater stands around you, 25,000 people on the hole. You go to tee the ball up and your hands are shaking. You can't get the tee in the ground. It's the most nerve-wracking I've ever been. You know, daddy, daddy, daddy. We've all heard of those stories. So what the reframing of it I tried to do to the players, and certainly at the tee meetings the night before, was, you know, when we get in that first tee, I know you're going to be nervous. Everybody's going to be nervous. That's natural. You're all used to being nervous because otherwise you wouldn't be in the team and you wouldn't have the success you would be to be on this thing, on this team. But just remember, when you stand in that tee and you stand behind the ball, you look down the fairway and it's 10 deep the whole way down around the tree and the place goes quiet. Just remember the noise that's going to raise if you smash this down in the middle of the fairway. So rather than thinking, I hope I make contact, I hope I don't duff it, I hope I don't squirt it out right or whatever, just think, I've got the power of 25,000 people in the palm of my hands here, and I'm going to make them go ballistic. And I can't wait to hit the shot, to hear the noise. And then when you do hit a good shot, the adrenaline rush that rushes through you when you've performed and you raise them, you know, that's what the ego, playing to the ego of all of us who play sport. And I'm sure people who perform in concerts or music or whatever, they feel the same way. You know, saying something and immediately the crowd get a reaction like that. And that's what it's like in the Ryder Cup, because, you know, playing at home, particularly, everybody is for you. So that's the mindset I tried to bring in, because that's, you know, a lot of my moments in Ryder Cups, that's and in team events, that's what I felt when there's a big crowd around, where I've got the control of the people around the green here. I want them to cheer.
I know that's something you did on a very individual level with a few of the players as well. Like Kaimer, for example, you were trying to tap into him having his nation watching him and him doing his nation proud, whereas someone like Ian Poulter, for example, it might be something completely different. Do you mind just sort of touching upon how you're able to scope out different people's motivations and then sort of how you play to that in your communications the night before matches and in the tournament?
Well, I think a lot of that goes into the prep. Obviously, I knew the players all very well. I played with them. I played right at cost with a lot of them. I played on tour with them for years and years and years. And then as I became captain, I became an amateur psychologist, and I started getting into the mindset. I'm a great believer in the individual first as part of the team. It's not just going in and be a team. It's the individual first. Take care of the individual. Everybody is in their own little bubble, and not everybody is ticked the same way. And everybody's got different motivations. So you try to get underneath their skin and you try to understand, what is the motivating factor here? What is the thing that's really going to get them emotionally engaged? I'm a great believer in that. And all of us get emotionally engaged in different ways. So you take Martin, for example, who's a very proud German and a big soccer fan. And, you know, so, you know, it was along those lines. They won the World Cup earlier that year in 2014. Germany, the country, had gone mad. He'd been part of that and very excited about it. So it's just trying to blend that in to say, you know, Martin, people who are watching at home, watching the Ryder Cup with all that emotion, that patriotism, going to be doing the same in the Ryder Cup, because they're tuning in, yes, to watch Europe, but particularly Martin Kaimer. And, you know, when you're out there, you're representative of them, just taking the bars and the restaurants and the golf clubs and your family and everybody home doing that. And it was something similar with Sergio. He's very, very patriotic. I'm very proud of the Spanish roots. I'm very, very connected with the world of soccer. And, you know, it was a case of, you know, tuning into his Spanish background and at the world of soccer, watching them and, you know, the big soccer stars in Real Madrid, which is his team, will be watching him and cheering him in the context of a team environment. I had to feel energized that way. And so everybody in a different way, you know, Ian Poulter is the, you know, he just loves the moment. He just loves to be in the moment. And he loves fans cheering for him, and he loves to be loved. So it was tuning into that. Graham McDowell was about responsibility. And so, you know, for him, it was about, look, I need you to play this role with Victor Dubis on the first 2 days. But if you do that, I'm going to put you out number one in the singles and lead the team out. Again, I was playing to his sense of responsibility, which I think was really important here. You know, a guy with a big, big heart, as we know, he's the guy that I wanted to lead out the team, and he delivered. So it was amateur psychology, and also the fact that I knew him so well, and lighting the fire of each individual. I think that's really, really important. No matter what the team, whether it be a soccer team, whether it be a business team, whether it be an office, no matter what it is, I think it's really important to get to know the people in your team individually, as well as what they can do in a work capacity individually. Because, you know, that's where real emotion, when you get that heart engagement, that's when real magic happens.
How do you reckon you can do that in the workplace when sometimes people are maybe a bit closed off? They want to leave their kind of home life away from work. They want to keep it separate. How do you think that you can kind of tap into what's going on behind work and what their real emotions are?
Again, all I can do is talk about it, because it's the same in golf. You know, a lot of players are guarded. You know, they don't want to let you in, so you've got to find a way of doing it. What I did is the old-fashioned Irish way of chat. And, you know, don't underestimate the value of alcohol every now and again. Go for a beer up to the pub and having a bit of crack. And, you know, by getting information and getting information from the team around that individual, you know, and, you know, getting to know, get a broader picture of who they are, what makes them tick. And, you know, they call it in America, the water cooler chat. You know, and I'm all for that. I think that's brilliant. You know, having a chat where you're having, making a coffee with someone, what are you up to the weekend? Where are you going? And, you know, you get to know people. You'd be surprised at what people will open up in a social environment. And you're not prying, but you're trying to get an understanding of what makes them tick. And then as a leader of that team, that's very important. You know what? You begin to develop the big things in their life that are really important to them. So, you know, for example, if somebody's, you know, family is absolutely crucially important, you know, just finding out when their kid's birthday is, or when there's, you know, something going on and, you know, just leaving a cake on their desk. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to tell people what to do, but just things like that. And that's how you get leaders become kind of engaged, and are they showing that they really care for the individual in the office, and, you know, sending them a, you know, an email on their birthday and wishing them good, you know, happy birthday, or one of their kids' birthdays, or whatever, have a great day, or a little present, something like that. And that's all done in a social way. It can't be done in a structured environment. Come meet my office down and then pile a whole load of questions at them, because that's going to put the defenses are going to go up. It's got to be done in a more subtle way, in a social way, but not in a prying way. It's got to be done with authenticity. That's really, really, really important in a leadership role, is authenticity.
Yeah, I love that philosophy, Paul, because I think, yeah, there's so many different ways to make people tick, whether it's an arm around the shoulder, whether it's more of a kick up the backside and everything in between. And it's really important to build that rapport to get the best out of people. And it sounds like you absolutely did that in 2014. I think on a similar theme, there's something else that I read that you did was, while treating them all as individuals, you also allowed them to do their own individual routines rather than making everyone go for team dinners and really do team activities. You actually let them do their own schedule and their own preparation as they would on any other week of the year.
Yeah, well, that was all part of the individual first, you know, take away the structure of what they have to do. Because remember, this is a unique environment. You've got these guys from the very, very early age. Most of them are from their mid-teens, you know, are superstars or superstars in the making in their mid-teens. And they've been brought up, we talked about Nick Faldo earlier, about in that kind of selfish environment of just you in an individual sport. And you have to be very selfish to be successful in an individual sport, whether it be golf or tennis, whatever. You've got to be, it's got to be all about you. You don't have teammates to rely on. So having that, you know, they nourish that and they were cultivated in that way. And as a result, when they get on tour and become successful, they're still very much individuals. As much as we're all friends out on tour, we're still all very much individuals. That you, your caddy, your coach, maybe your manager, a couple of people around you, and that's it. So what I tried to do was, every 2 years, you get the Ryder Cup comes together, and all of a sudden, these guys who are trained to be individuals are thrown into this environment, this washing machine atmosphere of being a team. It's out of their environment. It's out of their natural habitat. So what I tried to do was make that habitat as normal as it would be on a week-to-week basis, because that's what they're used to, that's what they thrive under, and that's, you know, so if they wanted to come in and mold with each other and let them do under their terms, not being forced on by the team. So that's why I took away a lot of the structure as much as I could. There's a meeting every night from 9 o'clock to 9:10, and that's it. It's only 10 minutes long every night. Other than that, there's a buffet room from 5:30, finishes at 10. Come and go. If you want to get a massage, you want to go to the gym, you want to go out with your wife, you want to meet your mom and dad, you want to go, you know, into the public rest, whatever you want to do, you do. It's your time. Whatever you would do in a major championship. And as long as you're there for that meeting at 9 o'clock. And the irony is that the more I let them do all of these things and give them the freedom to do all of that, the irony is, what do? They all come back into the team room. Now they're in on their terms, though, not because they're told to do it. They're playing, you know, table tennis with each other and having a crack and having a bit of banter, and the caddies are involved, you know, and so it's an organic way of molding the team. I think that's been taken on since then more and more. I mean, I didn't start it. It was something that we were toying with in the previous Ryder Cups, and I brought it to a new level. And I think since then we've moved that on. But interestingly, like a lot of things we do in Ryder Cup, you know, Americans have followed us, and they're doing similar things as well.
I know that went down to even in play as well. Like when the match was going on, you didn't speak to the players directly. You didn't sort of hover behind them and say, oh, you should be hitting this club, this is the approach you should be taking. You very much let them get on with their thing, because they had this secret sauce. They'd won majors, they won massive championships. So kind of why would you mess with it as match is going on?
Absolutely. Again, you know, it's about the individuals, and them and their caddies make brilliant decisions. That's why they're on the team. That's why they're winning major championships. And that's why they're winning tournaments. And that's why they're one of the top 12 players in Europe. So I don't want to infiltrate that in the middle of play. You know, you don't want somebody in your ear who doesn't really know your game as well as you and your caddy. So I promised all the players and the caddies at the start of the week, I will not be getting involved unless it's absolutely essential. And if I do want to get involved and I do want to speak to a player, I'll ask the caddy to let me know when I can speak to him. So, you know, give them the authority to the caddy to let me know when a good time was. But my job was not to go out there, you know, and tell Rory McIlroy to hit a 5-iron rather than a 6-iron, or Stephen Gatler to hit a 9-iron and be careful with the pin position here. That's just going to complicate things. As I said earlier, you know, being in the zone is about simplicity, and I wanted to keep things as simple as possible and as normal as possible when the players were on the golf course. And I think that's really important. You know, the Ryder Cup captain is more of a manager than a coach. You're managing the situation. You're not coaching the players. I'm not coaching the players the way, you know, Eric Van Tag would do in Man United, or Guardiola would do. I don't coach them, tell them how to play. They have people that do that. My job is to manage the situation. And, you know, it should be really called a Ryder Cup manager rather than captain or coach.
Yeah, I love that as well, Paul. I think what you did by doing that is you're empowering the players rather than overpowering them, which I think is just a really important leadership quality. And I think other leadership qualities that you probably demonstrated throughout your time as captain, or maybe helped advise by one of the greatest leaders of sporting history, perhaps Sir Alex Ferguson. I know that you touched base with him ahead of the 2014 Ryder Cup. Can you just give us a bit of an insight of how that came about and what sort of things he taught you and the players?
Well, I played with him about 6 or 7 years previously in a pro-am. When I became captain, I sat down, I looked at all the challenges I had. I looked whether I was going to be strong, or what I knew about, where I was going to be, I needed some help with. And, you know, a couple of questions, like, you know, one of them, I said this before, but one of them was like, you know, I played in 3 Ryder Cup teams, and I played in, you know, a lot of SETI trophies and Royal trophies, but I was always in the second part of the team. I was always 6-12 in the team. I was never the superstar on the team. So, what about the superstars of the team? You know, what way do they think? How do you manage them in the media? What do you say to them? What put pressure on you, take pressure off? So managing them was one of them. So challenges like that. So and I looked, I thought, yeah, you know, I'll be doing some, and I thought, you know, where am I going to get? I'm a great believer in sounding boards. Who's the sounding board for that? And Alex Ferguson came to mind. He just retired from Man United. So anyway, long story short, I got in touch with him. We had a couple of lunches over the year, and we had a couple of conversations on the phone, a few emails and stuff. But I always went to him prepared with specific questions. It wasn't just going and, okay, Alex, tell me how to captain the Ryder Cup team. You know, that's way, first of all, that's showing your weakness, because, you know, you want somebody else absorb over responsibility to somebody else. So, but there were specific areas that I needed a little bit of insight. And that was one of them, managing the top players and superstars. And one of them, you know, he managed obviously Ronaldo and Beckham and Giggs and, you know, all of those guys keen in their day. So that's the kind of way that I used them. And then we got on so well, I asked him, would he come then to speak to the players on a Tuesday night? And he said, okay, look, I'll come and I'll speak on two conditions. A, nobody knows, so let's keep it out of the media as much as we can. They're going to find out eventually, but let's not, you know, promote it before that. And I said, that's okay, that's easy. And the second one is, he said, you got to tell me what you want me to speak about. Give me the subject matter. Just tell me the areas that you want the players, that you're going to be speaking to the players about that you think are really important, because I'll go in unprompted and I'll just give stories along these lines. And then when you come in, they'll be able to think back to, oh, Alex Ferguson talked about that on Tuesday night, and that's a similar thing to what he said. So that's what he did. And I gave him six topics that were really important, I felt, for us. He came in and just told stories. You know, he wasn't coming in and you know, reading off a manual or standing at a podium. He treated them all. He just told stories. But the stories illustrated the points that I wanted to make. He was terrific. I can't thank him enough. I know he really, really enjoyed it as well. So he came back in. So he left on a Tuesday, he came back then on a Sunday, and we loved having him around. And the players loved him. And he was fun. You know, the Caddies were giving up sticks. Someone on Billy Foster, remember, was a Leeds fan, and they stole Eric Cantona from Leeds. So he let him know what he thought about him. You know, that's day for the 10 of the Tuesday night. You know, not the Caddies, they had a few drinks. And by the time they didn't know Alex Ferguson was coming in, next of all, I said, look, I've got a surprise for you. You know, I'll gather around here. I've got someone to come in and speak to you. Of course, he walks in the door, and it was just an avalanche of booing and cheering and swearing. It's dope that you could see that his face lit up. And you know, that's what it was. And then it got serious, and then he's talking about a few stories and the importance of it and what he's learned from teams. And so it was, you know, like all good, you know, to get messages across, it's got to be a balance between the getting the points across, but doing it in a fun way. When it's done in a fun environment, that's when the glue happens.
And that's what the Ryder Cup should be for players. It should be this 2-week opportunity where they come together, they have all these experiences, these fun experiences. They get to meet people like Sir Alex Ferguson they wouldn't potentially have met before. It should be that incredible experience for them rather than this incredibly pressured one that potentially commentators and ex-players refer to so much.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was the number one thing I wrote down to him, you know, and he asked me the six fundamentals. Fun. Every team that I've been in environment, we've had so much fun. Every team that I've been involved in, we've had so much fun. Yes, there's a lot of seriousness, and yes, there's a huge amount of pressure. But the main thing is the crack, the banter, the dressing room, you know, the winding up, the fun, slagging, practice round and having a crack and winning $100 off somebody and then slagging them out. That kind of stuff, that kind of environment's really, really, really important, because I think that's the platform. Once you create that platform, it's an easier jump to high performance than serious, serious pressure, pressure, pressure. That's a big jump from that environment up to high performance, because that's what leadership is all about. It's all about getting a result. Whatever way you got to do it, it's all about performance. It's all about getting performance out of your team. You know, and I never lost sight of that. As much as I'm doing all of these things, the main thing was that turned itself, cultivated into a performance.
Is it difficult to get that balance right then between being intense and focused and having fun? And were there ever times where maybe it slipped one way or the other and you had to rectify it?
Yeah, absolutely. It can easily do that. I mean, we had a good lead of 4 points going into the singles on Sunday, and I did the team meeting, and it was about resilience, and it was about what happened in Medina, the previous Ryder Cup, and America taking your foot off the gas, you know, us being able to come back at them and gaining momentum and one thing and another. And I gave a very strong 10-minute meeting on the importance of the America are not dead yet, going to come at us, you know, we got to be resilient. And as the players were leaving the room, I turned to Des Smith and one of my vice captains. I said, no, I don't think I got that message across. He said, no, it was good, it was good. And I said, I don't think so. It was a bit of laughter, a bit of crack, a bit of banter. What I wanted to do was kill the mood. It was too high, and I wanted to kill it a bit. We were too giddy, we were playing too well. I wanted to bring it down a notch or two and back a little bit more of that seriousness and understanding and that focus that we have a massive job to do tomorrow. So I decided to go down to the team room where I knew the players most of them were going to go down afterwards, you know. And I went around each player and I had words with them individually about their own game and why it was important to them, going back to the individual, why it was important to them. You know, Rory McIlroy was playing against Ricky Fowler, who was a young up-and-coming American guy that, you know, many people had tipped to, you know, win the majors and be the rival to Rory McIlroy. And, you know, just talking about the opportunity Rory had playing well in front of his own crowd, you know, to take care of business against, you know, who's somebody who's going to be, you know, in the years to come, a big rival to his. So, and each player I went through and talked about it, you know. Phil Mickelson was playing against Stephen Gallagher and it was an opportunity for Stephen to say, you know, Steve, you've nothing to lose here. Nobody's expecting to win. You know, you're playing against, you know, Phil Mickelson tomorrow, and, you know, and just taking that down and understanding that, you know, he wasn't expected to win. He was drawn against, you know, one of their top players, and you know, taking the pressure off him and giving them freedom to go and play. So that's what I did. So that's important. And gauging the mood, that's why being around your team is really important, gauging the mood. And also having good vice captains who are also good at gauging the mood. And then you just turn it up a couple of notches, you turn it down. Certainly you want to keep it here because the performance is here.
I think that's obviously the danger of success when you are four up with one day to go. There is the danger of complacency creeping in, and you obviously try to counteract that. I think another way that you tried to counteract the complacency was with that artwork that you had in the meeting rooms, and you had a piece of artwork that illustrated how the USA were actually far ahead of Europe in terms of the number of Ryder Cups they'd won. Could you just talk us through that and the other artwork that you had to sort of get across those messages?
Again, that was another one of the questions I had with Alex Ferguson at our lunches, was that for the first time ever in the history of the Ryder Cup, Europe are probably going to be slight favourites in the bookies. How do you handle being favourites, opposed to, we thrived on being the underdog all through the 7 years and everything. We were the underdog against the might of America. We thrived on that. We were those soldiers. We knew how to operate in that mode. But now we're going to be slight favourites. You know, what do you do, Man United, when you won the league and you're expected to win the following year and motivating the players again? And he talked about, you know, my big message to the players was always, that's another Premiership title out of the way, but look, we're still, you know, a number behind Liverpool. We're still chasing Liverpool. So I took that idea and I thought, ah, that's interesting, because let's use that. And it was again a reframing, and I got a big image done, right, into the great image from which was a faceless hand holding the Ryder Cup with a scroll coming out of it with a little flag against all the years that had won, who had won. And you know, you look at the right hand side of the flag. Yes, we've won 7 of the previous 9, and we were flying. But look at all the red over on the left-hand side. And the message to the players, again, at the meetings was, look, as much as we're having a great run, we're still miles behind how many Ryder Cups America have won in the history of the Ryder Cup. So we're still chasing them. So it was a reframing of trying to get them into that mentality of being the underdog, because I think that becomes more natural to us in Europe.
Yeah, I love that quote. I think I've heard you say that before, actually, of being the hunter rather than the hunted. And that's...
Yeah.
Kind of something that you associate with Man United teams. You know, they were so successful for such a period of time, and they were relentless and not complacent at all and constantly chasing their titles. It's kind of something you hear as well with other sports. You hear that about, like, Kobe Bryant, for example, about Michael Jordan. It must just be something that underlies all high performance and all their mindsets, really.
I think so. You know, certainly, again, my own experience, I think people are better on the front foot rather than the back foot. And it's about being on the front foot and chasing. And it's easier to be on the front foot if you're chasing something. I mean, how often do you see a soccer team go one down and all of a sudden they become a different team then in the next 15 minutes trying to get that goal back? I'm a great believer in that. I think it's less pressure to be chasing than it is to be defending. You know, we had a similar situation on the Sunday going in, and I got Lee Westwood to speak to the players. And that's what he talked about, was that, yeah, okay, we got a 4-point lead, but we've had 4 sessions so far, 2 foursomes and 2 fourballs. America have won 2, we've won 2. Yes, overall, we're 4 points ahead, but we need to win the singles in order to beat them 3-2 in the sessions. So that was another clever way of making us, you know, on the front foot. And they're the kind of ideas I think it's easier to play on the
on the front foot, and it's easier to be the underdog and picture yourself and paint yourself as being the underdog here with something to prove.
What I also love about that, Paul, is the fact that you've clearly got this message that you want to get across. You did it through so many different channels of communication. It was whether it's you, Sir Alec, Lee Westwood having a talk to the players, whether it's artwork in the meeting rooms or you speaking in the media to get a message across. There's so many different ways of you communicating it, because some players will receive different messages in different ways, and some are more visual learners or some better at speaking to someone. So I really like how you basically ticked a lot of boxes to speak to the players.
Absolutely. Consistency of messages is really important. I wrote a book. I didn't put it for public consumption. I didn't put it for sale, but I wrote a book to kind of synopsize all the things that I did, 18 chapters, different things. And then I did a video book on the back of that, talking about them. And you know, one of the big chapters was consistency of message, which is just exactly how you explained it there. It's important to keep repeating the same message over and over and over, but do it through different mediums. So it's not complicated or it's not boring because, oh, I've heard all this before. You can have the same message, but it's coming through different mediums. You know, it gets to people in different ways. And, you know, I had a lot of images with messages down the bottom of those images. So as you're walking on your way to your bedroom at night through the corridors of our segment of the hotel that was cordoned off, you know, obviously the Americans weren't seeing these. This was just our three floors in the hotel that were European. You know, the players would see, you know, a big strong image with the message underneath, and it would be, oh, he spoke about that at the meeting 2 days ago, or Alex Ferguson spoke about that, or, you know, so it's the same message, but through a different medium.
And I guess that ability to consistently get the same message across and the clarity of that message, in a way, would come from all the prep and all the years before that you've been able to prepare for that moment. And I know that in 2014, you actually had quite an approach with data towards the tournament. You'd analyzed Glen Eagles before, you'd realized that par five is where you might win it. You'd seen how previous winners had done it. Would you mind just telling us a little bit about that? Because I think actually at the time, that was quite a different approach to how other captains had taken it.
Yeah, again, my experience I've been a vice captain in the Ryder Cups, and my experience of being a semi-trophy captain is that I was the data guy myself, you know, and I was a vice captain to Elizabeth Montgomery. I was the data guy. So I was putting in sheets with, you know, in my book, and I listed all our players statistically, who was the longest driver, who was the shortest, who was the best putter, who was the worst putter, based on stats. And that's what our stats was by then. When I became captain, I wanted to bring it to another level and get a professional team in, which is what I did. But I'm also a great believer in what I learned is simplicity and clarity. And if you give an athlete way too much information, you're going to lose them. It's about getting them focused. And the best way to keep them focused is heart engagement, keeping it simple, and keeping it clear. And I was always conscious of that. So as much as the data team was gathering masses and masses of information, as much as I was doing unbelievable prep behind the scenes, the players only saw this thing. They didn't see all of this. And data is a good example of that. When I met the data team, they were doing unbelievable amount of hours and research and everything. And the two rules I have with them when I had meetings with them was, okay, you've got 10 minutes and you've got one page. And don't give me 10 pages and 20 pages, the big thing. I want three or four big points on one page, and that's it. I want you to talk about those. Give me the correlations to what we've got to do from a data point of view. So that's what I did. I'm a great believer in that. I learned that from, I remember watching 2010, Corey Peckham's captaincy, and somebody asked him that question, you know, what's the biggest thing you've learned over the 2 years journey to get to here, Corey? And he said, one of the American football coaches, it might've been Belichick, but I'm not so sure, who said, always make the big thing the big thing. And I always remember that. I still remember it. And taking this amount of information, but turning it into something very small. And easy to look at the marginal gains, and it's sexy to look at the marginal gains, and it's sexy to say that the marginal gains were the reasons why we won. But sometimes you don't see the wood for the trees, and because you're so caught up in looking at the marginal gains, you forget about what the big things are. You know, and the big thing, like I said earlier, is performance. How am I going to get a performance out? What's the quickest way to get to 14 and a half points here? What have I got to do that? But what the statistics telling me is the quickest way to get there. I'm taking that information, molding it with other information I have, and you know, hence you get your plan.
It sounds like you really utilized the data well then in 2014. What I'm interested to know is how you trade off the data and the analytics with the sort of human elements, and whether that's when you're picking the team and originally or whether you're selecting the pairings. How do you balance it between focusing on data and focusing on people's emotions and characteristics and personalities?
I think data is the lesser of the two. It's important. It's there. It's you know, Molinari, for example, was close to being picked. And if he was picking purely on data, he would have got the pick. But, you know, Ian Poulter, we know that he's going to raise his game when he gets there, you know. So he was an obvious guy that was going to get a pick, for example. You know, then it came down to, you know, Lee Westwood and what he was going to bring to the table. You knew what you were going to get with him. He had set the number of partnerships already formed in the team. I had roles in play, so obviously he's. So you know, data was important, but it wasn't the be-all. It was more important about my instinct, my sense, my feeling of who would, you know, as I say, how we're going to get the 14.5 points, what personnel we're going to use to get us the 14.5 points. And that's what I did more than anything. Because if you look at strictly data, that's fine. But then, you know, there's a very clever man said to me years ago, a businessman that I know, sport and business is all about performing in the allocated time. So I had to pick guys that I knew were going to perform in the allocated time, in the heat and the colder of a Ryder Cup, you know, and Francesco Molinari wasn't as experienced then as he went on to become. And at that moment in time, I felt that, you know, that the Lee Westwoods, for example, were going to give me less of a risk in terms of, you know, I knew he was going to perform, which is what he did.
It seems like there are some players who really do just turn up for Ryder Cups, that the likes of Ian Poulter, like you mentioned, and they really do raise their game. But what do you think the reason is behind that? And is there anyone who really stands out, whether it's Ian Poulter, Seve, or someone else, as the greatest European Ryder Cup player of all time?
Well, I mean, you could put a few into that. You know, you put Seve in there, you put Alazabal in there, you put Westwood in there, you put Sergio in there, and of course you put Poulter in there. And, you know, it's a matter of opinion as to which one you go with. I think Seve lit the fire more than anybody else. But yeah, Poulter's record was better than Seve's. So it's not just what you do in terms of winning points, it's what you also bring to the table. It's we're very lucky to have such guys that are emotionally engaged, like I said earlier, you know. And I think that's what we've had in Europe. We've been lucky to have players that are not great golfers, but they're driven to beat America. And they have a sense of injustice about when they go over and they're all professional careers to play in America. You know, Seve was like this, Montgomery was like this, Westwood was like this. When they went over to play in America as top European players on the PGA Tour, they never really were treated with the respect that their careers and their wins and their success in the European Tour deserved. And often they'd be put out last in a draw or late in the afternoon, and they wouldn't be with the TV groups and stuff like that. So that's one of the things that drove them. You know, and like I said earlier, that fire in the belly that we really started off this podcast on, and you know, I was fortunate to have that too, that drive and that sense of justice, that chip on your shoulder, that ambition that you have driving in your belly every day, that is absolutely golden. You know, and I see that, for example, in Tyrrell Hatton now, and I know we could talk a lot about his behavior and sometimes cringe about what he says and what he does, but the thing that I admire most about Tyrrell Hatton is that fire in his belly. Every day that he goes out to play golf, he's on fire. Now, you know, if you get that and cultivate it, that's when magic happens.
And those players too are around now are going to be playing in Ryder Cups in the coming years. How do you think it's looking for Team Europe in Rome later on this year?
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be favourites. I think we are in that somewhat of a transition period. But we do have the basis there of a very strong team with the best two players in the world, in my opinion, in Rob and Rory, leading us out. And, you know, you throw in the Fleetwoods and the Hattons and the Shane Lowrys in behind that, and the Victor Hovlands in behind that, the Matt Fitzpatricks in behind that. You know, that's more than half the team, which is what we did, you know, kind of how we won Ryder Cups in the 80s. You know, we had six or seven guys of that kind of standard. And then, you know, without due respect, kind of lesser careers who were able to fill up from 6 to 12. And I think that's what we're looking at again. We're looking at a number of rookies coming in. You know, Straka and Seamus Power are top 30 in the world. Both have had a lot of success in the PGA Tour. you know, well used to playing in environments and these big tournaments, you know, they would probably make the team. And then you throw in the rookies, you know, those Højgaard twins. I was very impressed with them at the Hero Cup. Obviously, we've lost Thomas Peters now, which is a blow because I really thought he would have added to it as he performed in the past, but it is what it is. I'd be amazed if he makes the team from where he, you know, having got to live now. And, you know, maybe the Bob McIntyres or the Migliossis from Italy. And then, of course, Justin Rose already won the PGA Tour. And he's coming back in. You put that him together with the six or seven guys at the top, you know he's going to perform at a pretty decent level. You know, and before you know it, you know, maybe a Molinari showing a bit of form, coming back to form in Italy again. And now we've got the nucleus of a pretty decent team. We're not going to be favorites. America are still going to be incredibly strong. We know that because not only are they great players, they've always been great players, but now they've really got their act together off the course. They've watched what we've done in terms of management of team, and they're making really good decisions in that way. And I'm sure Zach will be another addition of what we saw from Steve Stricker and David Locke before that, another addition of doing the same things that gave them success under those two captains.
It's certainly going to be very interesting to watch, and difficult to say which way it goes. You mentioned Rory there. He's probably going to be Europe's talisman this year, and he seems like he's come into real form recently. You come out and said that he's actually probably at the best version of himself right now. Why do you think that is, and do you think 2023 could be the year that he goes on and secures another major that he hasn't got for a while?
Yeah, I think he did great last year, all that was going on off the golf course, but there's two big additions to his team. Brad Faxon with his putting and Bob Rotella with his, you know, with the mental side of it. And I think those two have been huge and important additions to his team. And, you know, strengthened no end in those areas where he was probably, in terms of all the rest of his game, you know, they would be two elements that you think needed work. And he's brought in the right people at the right time to help with those. You just can see that now in statistics. And then you can see how in Dubai, for example, where he won last month, even though he had his best game, didn't have his best game, he still won with his kind of beat minus game. That couldn't have happened 3 or 4 years ago. Rory had to be on in order to win. Now we're seeing a different edition of Rory where he doesn't have to be really on his game and he can still cut out a win. So I think he's, if he can keep his focus, I know he did it last year. Can he do it for another year with all that's going on off the golf course? He's chairman of the players committee. He's kicking the Jay Monahan on the board on a regular basis. There's a massive issue, as we all know, going on in the game. And he's right in the center of it. He's getting ridiculed and criticized. And everybody's got an opinion on him because of the public stance that he had to take in the media and social media. And, you know, that can be a lonely place at times. So how he's going to deal with all of that is going to be the challenge. And is he going to continue? Is he going to continue to drive forward out of that? Or is it going to drain a little bit of his battery? That's the worry I have for Rory, you know, and full of admiration for what he did last year. Can he do it again for a second year? Because there's a lot of things draining his back.
Yeah, I'm a big Rory fan, and I hope he does doesn't have his battery drained this year, and he does go on to succeed. Recently, just watched the Full Swing documentary on Netflix, which has just come out, and it features Rory in that, of course, as well. Have you had a chance to watch it yet?
Not yet. I've seen little clips here and there, but I haven't had time to sit down and watch it yet. But I will do.
Do you think something like that is positive for the future of the game in terms of growing it and opening it up? We've seen what Drive to Survive has done for Formula One and really growing its audience. Do you think this documentary and that sort of thing is going to help to grow golf moving forwards?
I do. Yeah, I do. I mean, it's from what I understand, it's been pretty basic, this one, and anybody who knows golf like we do, we're not learning a whole amount we didn't know, but I think they have to do that in series one in order to bring people up to speed with what golf is. I think they can go a little bit deeper now in seasons two and three, which are coming. And season two is going to include the Ryder Cup, so that will be fun. They're going to have a bit of insight in both team realms, I understand. And that would be fun for people to see how that all figures out. So all in all, I think absolutely. It's another addition of what we're doing in the game. You know, the game is certainly got a lot of money in it at the moment, and the PGA Tour have a lot of money, and they're investing that in this new TV deal. You know, everybody says, oh, all of a sudden they found this money. But they found the money because the TV deal they signed was nearly three times, and that's kicked in this year, was nearly three times the one they signed before that. So, you know, that's where the money comes from. But everybody's got these conspiracy theories that they were hiding it underneath the bed, and all of a sudden they brought it out and giving it to the players. I can tell you from being on the inside and being on a board of the tour that they have cash in the bank, like all businesses should do. But the main reason for these injection of price funds is the new TV deal.
I think with pool swimming, like people are always going to try and compare it to Drive Survive. There are a lot of factors that contribute to F1 success. It's not just Drive Survive. And I think the difference with golf is there's obviously this massive participation element to it as well. It's not like people are going to wake up on a weekend and be able to get into a Red Bull car. It's completely different. So kind of having it that basic and potentially not having the rivalry between the players, it's kind of not as important. As the main thing is just people watching it, seeing that these golfers are potentially actually quite normal people and that anyone can have access to the game and play it.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the basis of it. And as I say, this first series is all about bringing people up to speed with what actually, bringing new people in. It's, I don't think that this first series was made particularly for the likes of me or you who understand the game and understand the characters within this. But it's a little bit of an insight, but more importantly, it's hopefully bringing more people in. I think it was number one download on Netflix there last week or the week before, which is, I think last week, wasn't it? It came out last week, yeah. So that's obviously good that a lot of people are downloading golf on Netflix. There's tens and tens and tens of millions of people on Netflix accounts. That's got to be all good news. And we talk about growing the game, and this is a good way of illustrating it in a very simple way.
Yes, certainly. Looks like there's going to be an exciting future for golf. Don't want to take up too much of your time, Paul, but just quickly, you're obviously going to be involved in the future of golf for some time. You're obviously broadcasting for Sky, and you've got some other sort of initiatives along the side. Can you just sum up what you're up to at the moment? How you're spending your time mainly?
Well, yeah, my a little bit of a spiral has come out of my right of captaincy in terms of my leadership thoughts. A lot of companies have had me in, big companies, huge companies, have had me in and I enjoy that, which is what we're talking about now, these kind of leadership insights. I'm not telling them what to do, these important business people, not telling them how they should do it, but giving examples of what I've learned and what my experience is at the pinnacle of professional sport and in terms of golf. So I'm enjoying doing that. I wrote a book on it, and I've also now done a video that's online about it. So that's a kind of a new tangent that's opened up I didn't expect. I do my TV work now, and it's not just Sky. I do with NBC as well as Golf Channel over here in America. So I do a little bit less with Sky, and I do a bit more with Golf Channel NBC. They're all under the one umbrella of Comcast, on all three. So that's another element. I still love to play, as I said earlier. I absolutely still love to play and practice and work. I've got a foundation that does quite well, raises a couple of $100,000 a year, and I try to invest that in some really good projects, which is all going very well. And then I have my ambassadorial work, which is corporate work that I still do, a number of companies that I represent still, and I enjoy working for them. And I do probably 20 days a year in that regard, maybe more in terms of doing corporate stuff, and I enjoy that. So there's a number of strings to my bow, I enjoy them all, but I still love playing more than anything. Although the leadership talks is something that I've really kind of gravitated towards. And I love, I'm really enjoying like this conversation that we're having now, because, I didn't come here writing down and listing all the things that remind myself when I have to speak. It's all in my head. But what happens is it's like a file in your head. When you ask me a question, it goes into a different file and it sparks out where I want. And I feel I'm better sometimes, that way rather than be ultra prepared. So, I enjoy getting questions, and I enjoy getting pushed in certain areas, because as you're asking a question, I'm thinking, where am I going to go with this? Or what example can I use? And I enjoy that. I enjoy the challenge of that.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly a lot to learn from your career as a player and as a captain and from everything you're doing now. And I mean, I've learned a lot just over the course of the last hour, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. People who read your book as well will learn a lot. Just quickly, where can they get your book?
Oh, you can get it on my Twitter page. It's got a link to it. My PA is called Emma. She takes care of everything. That will click into a page that you can get the book, and she'll get it set up. Right. The videos, the book is actually represented on video, which is online. I think you can Google that there or not. Or you can go through that page. Email Emma, she'll be able to put you in touch with a link for the videos, which is basically the same chapters with me speaking like I am now, and giving examples of it with some footage as well.
Great. Thanks, Paul. We'll share all that in the show notes. And yeah, just final question from me, and I'm not sure if Emma prepped you on this one or not, but it's a question that we ask all of our guests on the podcast, where essentially this podcast attempts to reveal the secrets to success and the lessons learned from athletes' lives inside and outside of sport. So we're asking each of our guests to give the game away by revealing their single greatest learning, reflection, or piece of advice from their journeys inside and outside of sport. So Paul, how would you give the game away?
Oh boy, I could talk for an hour on that. We could have another hour faster than that one. You know, transparency and integrity for me are really, really important. And particularly if you're in a leadership role, I think that's really, really important to be genuine in what you're doing. Because people can smell bullshit and they know if you're not, you know, you're not being authentic. So that's really, really important, certainly in a leadership role. In terms of the secret, I think the thing I've mentioned a few times on the pod here is the fire in your belly, you know, that can be harnessed and that can be cultivated. And we all have something that we're really, you know, emotionally attached to and something that energizes us. And if you can find and take that and grow it and treat it as your friend in there and feed it stuff to make it, you know, more and more, use that energy in a very positive way. That's the greatest gift that God can give you is that energy and that ambition and that sense of energy. You know, I think you can cultivate that. That's not just something you have or you don't have. We all have something that we're energized by. And take it and feed it and give it stuff and build it and you know, make it your friend.
Probably that fire in the belly thing is linked to smelling the bullets. Because if someone says, oh, I've got fire in my belly, I want to do it so much, this is something I want so badly, you can kind of tell if they're actually being genuine or not with it. But yeah.
They're both linked, yeah. And you can't fake it, you know. And
yeah, exactly.
Your body can't fake it. Your subconscious mind won't fake it. Now, I've done a bit of psychology over the years, certainly sports psychology with them, you know, the likes of Barbara Tella and Josh Bassett, who I worked with on tour. And you know, what I've learned from both of those guys is the power of the subconscious. You know, stuff you're not even thinking about, but, you know, the acts in your behavior. So, yeah, they will be the two things that I would say from a leadership point of view. Be authentic, be real, be transparent. And, you know, from a personal point of view, you know, feed that fire in your belly and be true to yourself.
That's amazing. Thanks, Paul. Well, I've certainly learned a lot over the course of the last hour, and I'm sure our listeners will as well. And I now feel empowered when I next stand over a putt on the 18th against my mate. So yeah, appreciate your time there, Paul, and for sharing your insights with us.
You're welcome, guys. Best of luck with the podcast. I look forward to hearing you. Thank you.